Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Our National Poetry Month celebrations continue with acclaimed poets Rigoberto Gonzalez and Johanny Baquez Paz. This program took place April 15th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Tonight's program is the latest in our ongoing Gene and John Rowe program series, My America and Refugee Writers Today. The AWM exhibit of the same name can be found online at my-america.org. And again, it is open to the public as of May 14th again. So if you want to come in and see the physical exhibit, it's really beautiful and engaging. The great poets of America describe this nation and all its complexities, beauty, stasis, ugliness, change. In his numerous works over the past two decades, Rigoberto Gonzalez is the son of migrant farmer workers, a poet of the gay Chicano experience, and one of the foremost chroniclers of the intersection between poetry and activism. He joins us tonight to talk with Johanny Vasquez Paz, whose journey from Puerto Rico to Chicago is described in her book, I Offer My Heart as a Target. I want to welcome both of our guests here tonight, and we are excited to have them both here. So welcome, Rigoberto. Welcome, Johanny. And I want to say thank you to you both for being here. Welcome. We talked a little bit in advance, and we'll talk, and I'll ask you both some questions that I think our audience will find interesting and we'd like to explore. But as April is National Poetry Month, and we are grateful to you both for being here, we were hoping that you both would take a couple of minutes to maybe read some work to our audience. So Rigoberto, do you want to start off?
Sure. And thank you so much for the invitation, and thanks everybody for attending. So I was, I'm working on my newest selected volume, which comes out in 2023. And I needed to do the new part, that's writing new poems. And since a number of these poems were written during the pandemic, I think that's what explains the texture to these pieces. Saint COVID, Saint Corona. We covet the birthmark dying on your face. If we had mouths, we'd kiss it. But the gods who made us give us windows through which everything escapes. The last man we held slipped out of our arms like a fish, and he took the entire canoe with him. Let us fondle your mole like a wet papaya seed, and we'll build something bigger, beautiful, and black, an avocado with a bubble of gold instead of a testicle. Let us love you from within. We'll change your tulips back to the poor white roots that growl like scars, and then the spidering commences, node crawling after node. We'll remember you each time a monitor crickets, because its chirp is just another small thing we let go. And though the gods who made us give us legs, we are like chairs to weigh down your chest in place. We travel nonetheless. When you sleep, we move into darkness. When you dream, we hide among objects. When you die, we guide you through the funnels of final song. Let us know when you're done making a honeycomb from the ball of wax that is your heart, and we'll show you how to turn the bed inside out. From your bones, the wood, from your skin, a shroud, from your tears, a dozen cherries on the ends of cigarettes. On the sick bed, among crows. Agony from the light bulb as you lick your dry teeth, watching the crows on the wallpaper. The crows want to pick what's left of you clean. What remains is still yours, however. Shoes that have lost not one, but both feet. A belt that no longer holds the belly up. Two nickels and a penny that missed the last pocket to the street. On the dresser, a dying man's wallet and the useless folds of its mouth. Your children taunt you, feigning normalcy from the family photograph nailed to the wings of the restless crows on the wallpaper. The shock in the crow eyes, dark as bullet holes, will not unfreeze. In fact, they're as full of rage as your body that wants to split open and set you free. For now, you're as trapped as a crow stuck to the wallpaper. Your wife is nowhere to be found. No use looking around anymore. She melted down with votive candles into a puddle of fat and grief. A replacement in a nurse's cap is too weak to swap the crows from descending while you sleep. The nurse has tired of dodging birdshit and wants to remain unseen. So she turns the light switch off. She's out in three, like the crows on the wallpaper. The dark crushes your lungs, kicking up dust you cannot swallow. And then not a sound, not even a cough, not even skid marks in the flurry of crows as they feed. And then I'll read just one more. This is a series of my border poems of a border crossings. This one's called Desert Lily. This white dress will not be worn again, says the wind, and the dress lets go of its fondest memory, clinging to the clothesline as it made believe it was a kite. How it soared gull-like through the sky, how it cast a shadow independent of a body and escaped the human grasp like sunlight or a butterfly. The past is a prison anyhow, as our names, says the wind. The wind arrives not because it's called, but because it's forgotten. When it wails, it mocks the old women who cry for the things they lost. This white dress will not be mourned, says the wind, and the dress comes alive even more. The ruffles on the hem opening and closing like the valves of a heart. Pebbles and sand erode from the cloth, and the white dress begins to flower once again, a desert lily that will glow with moonlight. This white dress, says the wind, belongs to no one. What strange freedom, this detachment from the living, from the scrutiny of eyes that covet or desire, from the touch and tug of human hands that value all they can possess or possibly destroy. This dress, this white dress, can invent its own beauty for a change. It can dress itself. Here, a collar made of larvae. Here, a scorpion for a buckle. Thank you.
Wow. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Rigoberto. Joanny, would you like to read a couple for us?
Yes, sure. I actually wanted to tell a little story before I read it. Well, this book, just in case you people don't know, I won the past poetry prize. Rigoberto was the judge. So I'm really grateful to him. This award is from the National Poetry Series and the Miami Book Fair. And I sent it in Spanish. And part of the award was that they have a translator, which is Lauren Schimmel. So the story goes, I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. And I grew up in a home. We were four sisters, my mother, my grandmother, all women. And I knew there was some kind of secret regarding my father. But when I was like 11, 12 years old, I finally found out that my father tried to kill my mother when she was pregnant of me. And the reason that they told us, me and my sister, is because there was some kind of problem. And my aunt was like, you guys need to know your mother went through that. So after that, I was always asking myself, I went to Catholic school, very Catholic family, why did I survive? God, why did you save me? I'm nothing special. Because everybody in my family told me that I was a miracle. I mean, my father stabbed my mother seven times in her stomach area, and I survived. So in the introduction that Rigoberto wrote, I want to read a little bit. And he says, the survivor speaks her truth, or rather, writes her way to truth as an avenue of expression, situating herself in a more desirable role as the woman who takes charge of her own strained but triumphant narrative. She has lived to tell her tale. So when I read that, she has lived to tell her tale. You finally, Rigoberto, answer my question. And I was always afraid to write about this because my mother doesn't want anyone to know this. She didn't want anyone to look at us differently. And this is the first poem that I write about this. And I'm going to read it both in Spanish and the translation in English. It's called Hija de la Violencia, Daughter of Violence. Mi madre duerme con la carga de otra niña en sus costillas. No siente la primera hendidura, solo un temblor, una sacudida, un trueno, quizá. Como caído un abismo, su cuerpo brinca cuando su alma regresa del país de los sueños. Espanta la realidad con el abanico incierto de sus pestañas al vuelo, pero la segunda estocada le asegura que las pesadillas estremecen menos que la mirada furibunda de mi padre. La piel de mi madre me protege, armadura endeble donde la tormenta me arrastra hasta el fondo. Si todo hubiera terminado allí, su vientre sería hoy mi tumba. Las voces que papá trajo de Corea le ordenan atacar una y otra vez. El estruendo de la guerra le persigue, disfrazando las súplicas, los gritos. Mi madre, 7 veces rota, se extingue en mi ombligo. Contra todo pronóstico, sobrevivimos. Sin saber cómo ni por qué, nacer fue no morir antes, vivir un milagro inexplicable. In English, Daughter of Violence. My mother sleeps with the burden of another girl on her ribs. She doesn't feel the first cut, just a tremble, a shake, a thunderclap, perhaps. As it falls into an abyss, her body bucks when her soul returns from the land of dreams. She frightens off reality with the uncertain fan of her fluttering eyelashes. But the second thrust assures her that her nightmares shudder less than my father's furious gaze. My mother's skin protects me, feeble armor where the stone drags me into the depth. If everything will have ended there, her womb will today be my thumb. The voices that he brought from Korea order him to attack again and again. The roar of the war chases him, disguising begging, the shouts. My mother, 7 times broken, vanishes in my navel. Again, all prognosis, we survive. Without knowing how or why, to be born was not to die before, to live an inexplicable miracle. I'm going to read the poem that gives title to the book. Ofrezco mi corazón como una diana, I offer my heart as a target. Some people thought it was too long, but Rigoberto has long titles too, so I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna do it. When I told some people the title, they were like, no, I like it. So I'm gonna read the English version again by Lawrence Schumel. I offer my heart as a target. If I search for my father in every man, his madness certified by doctors, his gaze clouded by war strategies, eyes lost on some battlefield, following the orders of an ownerless voice. If I allow the army of clone fathers to point their weapons in my direction, and I offer them my heart as a target, to serve them obediently as to my progenitor, begging for their blessing before the gunshot. If I search for whoever fills his shoes with footsteps, so they might stumble over my crystal wings. Whoever is always welcome, but never arrives. And I, with so much love, serve myself as the appetizer at dinner. I cook my guts. I bake a pile of my viscera, pack and seal the unwanted leftovers, so they reheat my dignity whenever they desire. If I search for my father in every man, I'm afraid than in addition to flat feet, trembling skin, and a broken mirror. I inherited my mother's tragic story. Thank you.
Those were amazing. Thank you so much for that. And thank you, Rigoberto, for your words. I'm going to ask some very general questions and hope that we can, you know, kind of hop into a discussion about writing and both of you and your work that you do and some of the parallels. One of the things I wanted to ask about is just simply the nature of why writing. You've both had very interesting experiences growing up, where you grew up, coming to the US when you did, at different ages. Can you talk to me a little bit about why writing and why poetry are important to you? What drives you in those areas?
It was the only thing I could do. It's funny, like I say, they told me you're a miracle, and I'm like, I'm not good at anything, because I always like art. And I wanted to paint, I wanted to sing, I wanted to play an instrument. I don't know. So I never thought that writing it was nothing special until someone told me, but you write. I'm like, everybody can write. I know, I cannot even do a letter. So, and then, oh, well, maybe that's it. But my grandfather, from my father's side, was a poet. And they used to take us there to visit my father. So he had mental problems, mental illnesses. So he lived with my grandparents. So I remember that we went to visit them. I was the youngest one. I was always kind of bored. So there was once a book on the table, and I grabbed it, and it was a poetry book. And it was dedicated to my grandfather. And he saw me reading the book, and he got really excited. Oh, do you like it? I'm like, oh, yeah. And then he'd say, oh, take it, you know. And I took it home. And I think that was it. You know, for me, that's, I discovered a way of expressing all of this. You know, when you find out things like that about your family, and then there's a secret, and you know your family doesn't want you to talk about it. I mean, I really don't know everything yet to this day, because every time that I try to ask my mother, she still cannot talk about it. But it's just poetry. In a way, I told a friend of mine, I think I was born a poet, because this tragic, you know, that happened, and then we were four sisters, and two already died before my mother. So it's like, I don't know. I have a happy life, okay, but a tragic history. I don't know how to explain that.
And that opportunity of your grandfather being, you know, in a book, of connecting to a book and seeing that as a means of expression, I think that's a really interesting note to think about, something that drove you down that path. Rigoberto, what drew you to writing? What made you want to be a writer, or what sent you there?
Well, two things were kind of collided to, or were complicit in turning me to poetry. One is the fact that very few members of my family could read or write, mostly illiterate. And I think that since I was young enough, when we came to the U.S., I was 10 years old, I was expected to learn English as quickly as possible to be able to translate, but also to be able to read whatever literature we got in the mail. And I think that gave me a particular value and standing in the family, even though there were other ways in which I felt marginalized. So I think that immediately I kind of adopted this ability, this skill to read and write as a superpower. And I think that that I became a voracious reader. There were books in the house, even though nobody really read except me. And that had my own bookshelf, and people respected that bookshelf. They knew that was for me, because that was my function in the family. So the I always tell my students that the journey from being a reader to being a writer is so small. It's not even a leap. It's just like a step to the right or step to the left. Because eventually, if you're a good reader, a voracious reader, you learn, you want to be part of the creator as well. So I think that I began to fantasize, you know, in my teens about being able to write these stories that helped me through a lot in so many ways. One, to understand that there's a bigger world than the one I had been born into, that there were other opportunities for me, and not just those that that my family had was offering me as a farm worker. And I decided then and there that I wanted to be part of this other world, and that I didn't necessarily have to leave my old world. Physically, yes, but in other ways, I did not. And eventually that the two worlds came together through my writing, because I do write about the border. I write about immigrant experience. I write about my own experiences. And so that's the alchemy of it all.
And so, you know, for you both then, you know, as you've found writing, you both have discussed books that, you know, hit you and maybe got you going. And as you said, that step from reader to writer. What are some of those books for you, both of you, that ignited you, that inspired you, that made you, that have influenced you? You know, what are some of the big ones that hit you?
Well, for me, Puerto Rico, Julia de Burgos, it's like the mother of Puerto Rican poets, but especially female poets. There's another Puerto Rican poet that I really admire, Angela Maria Davila. I was always really interested in reading the women poets. Mm-hmm. You know, Julia de Burgos, I think, is cool. Maybe one poem, you know, you read whatever, but it's mostly men. I will have to say that Pablo Neruda probably, too. I read a lot of Pablo Neruda, but that was... And I think because they were easy to get, the Pablo Neruda books, you know, because I have older sisters that went to school and those books were made, you know, was around the house. I think in every bookstore that you go, you're going to find a Pablo Neruda book, but many other writers, you didn't. So the other that, you know, the book that my grandfather gave me, it's not from a famous Puerto Rican poet, but really affected me. And I do remember, because I like prose too. I love to read novels too. There's the Spanish female writer, Carmen Laforet, and she wrote this novel named Nada, which means nothing. And I found that book in my house. And Nada, wow, it was gonna. So it helped me, that book, is to learn that there's another world. There's other people with dysfunctional families like mine. And it made me feel so much better. You know, it's like when you read a novel or whatever, you kind of escape from your own reality. And I travel a lot. Coming in an island, you know, I travel a lot in my imagination through all the books I read.
Yeah. How about you, Rigoberto? What were the ones that got to you?
I had three gateways. The first one was just as I was learning English, remember a teacher giving you a book of poetry, a verse, New England and British. And I didn't understand much of it, but I understood the rhythms of it. And I always tell a story that one of my favorite poems, without knowing what it was about or who it was Alfred Lord Tennyson's The Charge of the Light Brigade. You know, because I love the sounds of it, and it sounded like a song. And so that was, and of course, you know, Emily Dickinson was also in that anthology. And I didn't have a bigger context for what I was reading, but I understood music because my father had been a musician, because we played music in the house. So these for me were kind of songs, you know. And I did, you know, when I was in school in Mexico, we did have to memorize a lot of patriotic verse, but it had a very different flavor than what I was enjoying in the American poetry, because I was learning English. So there's a different kind of magic, right? Eventually, when I went to college, I realized for the first time that writers were actually people that were alive, because all through high school, all the writers that we read were all dead. So I thought books are written by people who are already dead. So it wasn't until college that I realized that this was actually something that I could be, that I could do, because I met writers, including my teachers, and they were creating verse, they were creating stories in the current moment, reflecting the current times, right? And I think the third one had to be the Chicano poets of the 70s. Tomás Rivera, he was the man whose name was on the library where I went to UC Riverside, Tomás Rivera Library. And I looked him up and I saw that he was a farm worker, that his family traveled in the Midwest in the 1930s, 1940s. And I thought, wow, okay, well, here it is again, all coming together again. You know, a writer with a similar story than me, writing about people that I understood. And I said, well, then that's it. There's no more excuses. I'm going to be this kind of writer, and these are the books that are going to matter.
So those are wonderful notions of the gateways that have got you to this point and drove you to write. I'm curious, you know, listening to the poems that you were reading earlier, you know, you said a couple of those you're working on, they're new. So what's the process there? You know, as you're working, are you, you know, for you, what is the process, Rigoberto? And then, Giovanni, I want to ask you something more specific, but what's your overall process for working on poetry? Because you're also a memoirist, so, you know, are you moving back and forth? Are you staying in poetry for a while? What is that?
No, I was working on two books at the same time. One was a book of poetry, and I was also working on my fourth and hopefully final memoir about my family, about my grandmother specifically, and I was working on both simultaneously. I have no problems going back and forth. These demarcations, these boundaries, were not a thing for me until I went to graduate school, where I was told that to specialize in either poetry or fiction, as many writing programs do that. And I had no idea, because the writers like the Marivera wrote poetry and fiction. And then other writers that I admired, you know, like Octavio Paz, you know, wrote poetry and journalism and fiction. So for me, the Latin American writers were multi-genre. I thought, well, that's what a writer is. And I thought, well, that's what I'm going to be. I wasn't until graduate school, right? So when I sit down to write something, it's really just what strikes my fancy. I always say I have many files open, and I go back and forth, and I read, and I look at this, look at that. And all of a sudden, one of them is going to snag me for a bit, and that's where I'm going to stay for the rest of the day or for that hour. I don't necessarily work on two projects in one day. I could do like one day one, another day a different one. But I've learned how to be disciplined about that. You know, people ask me why, you know, because I there were years that I published a book of poems and a fiction book or a nonfiction book and a fiction book. So I've done all these combinations, and people always ask, well, you know, how is it that you can keep them separate? I go, well, I really don't. I mean, creatively, I don't keep these things separate. You know, when I'm on the page, definitely I'm looking at something different, but the creative process is very similar. It's just like surrendering to the project, is allowing it to guide you toward one direction or another, and then sort of using whatever resources I have in my imagination and in my experience and my observations to shape something that's going to make sense to other people.
And so in that process, along with writing in these different genres and working on different projects at the same time, you're also teaching.
Yes.
Do you find that reading other people's work while you're doing that and trying to guide them, does that affect you?
I used to think it did, because when I was in graduate school, I would hear my teachers complain that they didn't have enough time for their work because they were focused on the student work. And so I stayed away from teaching for 8 years. I said, I'm not going to go into teaching, even though I had a number of books and I could apply for a job, but I refused to. I said, I don't want to do that, because I don't want to be that person that complains. And I said, if you know you're not going to be able to do work while doing that job, if you already know ahead of time, why would you sign up? Right? So I decided, you know, I'm not going to do it. Eventually, you know, I got pulled in because I needed this before Obamacare. I needed the health insurance. And I began to understand that when I work with the student work, when I talk to the students, that conversation was actually inspiring me. That conversations were actually exciting me about going home to write. You know, they were exhausting, absolutely. It's an exhausting occupation, definitely. Teaching takes a lot of energy. But what I found out is that it did not diminish or did not dissipate my own love of writing. If anything, it kept it going.
Wow, that's wonderful. Giovanni, do you want to talk a little bit about your process? And also, because I want to transition from that to also the notion of language. You know, you're writing in Spanish. So, you know, are you... You're bilingual, but are you ever thinking about this in English in any way,
I'm a rebel. I refuse to give up my language. I, you know, it, it's rebellious. I'm telling you, there are. I have a group of in Chicago. There are a lot of good writers. You know, that are writing in Spanish and they are publishing books and things like that. And I have been advised not to do it. You know, I have been advised to write in English, that it would be better and things like that. But I also, you know, want to promote bilingualism. And I don't understand why so many people are against it. I mean, I'm in Puerto Rico and English or Spanish are the official languages, and it's a territory of the United States. So here they could do that. They should welcome more this thing of learning different languages, and of course Spanish would be the most logical one, but all others too. Like in Europe, in some countries, many people, you know different languages, and especially because it, you know, in this country, you know, half of the country used to be Mexico, and there's just Spanish is so beautiful. It's better for poetry. And I teach Spanish. So, you know, it's something, but it's hard. And sometimes, you know, in my mind, since I have, since I know both languages, sometimes I write it in Spanish and I'm translating at the same time. You know, I don't usually have, you know, the luck that someone is going to, an expert translator is going to translate my work. So it always playing with that, you know, but I think I'm going to remain writing in Spanish for now. I do write prose, you know, I have published a few short stories. Funny that for short story or prose, I feel that I need more time. That for poetry, because I can feed a poem every day. I don't know. I can feed it every day, you know, or until it's perfect. But I think when it's a story, you have to keep the narrative voice all the way, you know, and I don't know. And it happens that really affect me. Like, I'm in that other universe that is the story. Once I wrote this short story called The Mute, about a woman that pretends to be mute because she doesn't want to speak English, because people react. Anyway, and then one, my husband one day is like, what's the matter with you? Why are you so quiet? Are you angry with me? And I'm like, I noticed that I'm not talking, you know, because I'm here in my mind when I was not writing the story. You still have I still have her voice, you know.
So when it comes to process, you're definitely seeing different things happening between when you're writing prose and when you're writing poetry.
It's funny that my first book, which I wrote the poems kind of when I was at USC doing my master's, was, you know, I came to Chicago and I learned about the you know, David Hernandez, the slam poets, the new Eureka poets, you know, like Pedro Pietri or something, you know. And in my first book, it's more like that, more colloquial, more performance, more kind of was very much affected. So I think because for me, poets in Puerto Rico are more traditional. There are a few. I mean, I don't know Urayoan, but he doesn't live in Puerto Rico anymore, that I'm more performant, I'm more whatever. But in general, I think most of the poets are more traditional. You know, I have heard many famous poets in Puerto Rico, you know, when they hear this slam poetry, they say, oh, that's not poetry, that's like rap, you know. So I think I'm affected by both styles. But the person that I am, the poet speaks Spanish, even if she puts English sometimes.
For both of you, I'm curious, you know, we've touched on the notion that you've both come to the U.S., you know, but of course, Puerto Rico is, as you said, a territory. So you're a citizen from the get-go of the United States. So it's not that you're immigrating so much as simply moving from a territory to the continental U.S. Rigoberto, you were born in the U.S., but raised in Mexico, and I know your story. Can you talk about, both of you, how your journeys from one place to another have affected you as writers?
I think that, this transition had many layers for me. And I write this, I've written this in Butterfly Boy. It was the coming to America, was also coming into another language, was coming into education, was also coming out. All these things happened, around the same time in my adolescence. So I think that to try to find some kind of kinship, to try to find some kind of connection, as Giovanni was mentioning earlier, that we read to find a mirror, we read so that we don't feel alone, right? And on that, by the token, I think that when I wrote Butterfly, my first memoir, and even Soften the Pitcher Goes to Water Until It Breaks, the first book of poems, is that I also wanted to find connection by having readers who understood these worlds that I was inhabiting, who understood at least something of the many things that I was dealing with or discussing or talking about. And that was also very useful. When I got either emails, responses from readers, or when I read and I had somebody walk up to me, that felt amazing, because I realized that, here's yet another way in which I'm not alone. Right? And so that's what it was for me. It's like, well, I'm all these things. What do I do next? I find my community. I found it through the libraries and the bookstores. Well, now how can I find these other individuals who may or may not be writers, right? How can we connect so that this I'm doing is not a lonely journey, because it was going to be a long one. The writer's journey is very lonely anyway, because we compose in isolation, right? And so this was the way to connect, a way to feel as if what I was writing about mattered to someone else other than myself.
Giovanni, what about your journeys?
First of all, I just read someone commented that Puerto Rico is not a territory, a colony, and I totally agree with you, okay? So I want to put it out there. For me, the word territory is as bad as colony. Well, like I said, I was born and raised. I came to the United States first to go to university. In Puerto Rico, I was very middle class. I went to a very modest Catholic school. And a lot of friends that I had, came to United States for university, and you will go back. And there was this idea, the fact that we're a colony, like if your degree is from the United States, you have a better chance of getting a good job that you go to the University of Puerto Rico, which was actually probably better than many universities here back then. I don't say now, I don't know a lot about what it is right now. So when I first came, I went to Terre Haute, Indiana. Indiana State University. That was an amazing cultural shock. It was horrible. I don't know how to explain it. First, I was not used to the weather. I didn't have appropriate clothes for the weather either, or money to buy it. I was very shocked about the fact that Blacks were in a corner, literally, and Blacks in the in the university, because there's a university campus. I didn't know which corner I should stand. It was really hard, really. It was, and then the fact that I'm a U.S. citizen didn't matter, because people didn't know that Puerto Ricans were U.S. citizens. So everywhere that I go, you see, if I keep quiet, then when I open my mouth, they were not used to foreigners in general, and they're, where are you from? And I, Puerto Rico, like, what? Where is that? In Mexico? If my mother sent me a check at the bank, this is a different currency. We use dollars too. If I wanted a job, they say, give me your green card. And like, but we are citizens. They are like, no. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to carry a encyclopedia with me, so they know I'm not lying. So we go through, the same things, other than, actually when we get our papers, they cannot send us back. you know, but you go through a lot. And then I'm being writing all the time. So I went back to Puerto Rico and then I moved to Chicago. I forgot how the winters were, I guess. But when you live in a colony, you know, it's hard to make a living, you know, and I also feel, you know, that I was pushed to move out. Because when I went back with my bachelor's degree, the only job I could get, you know, didn't pay enough for me to have my own place and my own things. And then you have to, so how am I going to survive? And we human beings, we do whatever to survive, even if it means that you're going to miss everybody and you're going to cry every night.
And I'm assuming that that is one of the things that is driving some of the writing and what you're doing. You know, we've talked about this notion of your journeys and how that impacts you as writers. I'm curious, you know, when you look now at where you're at, you know, Rigoberto, you're in New Jersey, and Joanny, you're here in Chicago. Where do you see home for you, and how does that impact your writing in what you're writing about?
You know, it's interesting because that saying, you can never go home again. I think I learned what that means, at least for me. I learned what that means. And that just means that home has changed. That my memories, my nostalgia, my love for home is also connected to a certain time period and to a certain stage of my life. And just like I can't go back to being 20 years old, it's difficult to go back home and see the same things that I grew up loving, that I grew up appreciating. So it's just memories, right? And so I think that's the home, I think, for many of us writers, that leave our homes is the imagination, right? Or the memories and the writing, that's where home is, because we recreate it, we revisit it whenever we write, and we go back to it whenever we remember it. Many of us are not lucky enough to be able to go home for one reason or another. Those were in exiles, those were refugee. And I think that those writers are teaching the rest of us how to deal with that distance, how to deal with that separation, you know, from home. So that's really what it is. You know, it's a void, you know, but thankfully we can recover it, you know, through many different ways, through creativity. And that's where home is.
Ronnie?
Oh, my God. I don't know. You're going to make me cry. You know, I just went. Well, what can I tell you? Let me tell you. In 2019, my older sister died. And I had to spend the whole summer. She had cancer. This is hard. The thing is that right now, I'm angry with Puerto Rico. Mm. I blame Puerto Rico for my sister's death. Not because, I mean, everybody can get cancer, but the hospital, the treatment, I don't know. I mean, it was really hard. To the point that I, you know, even though I live in Chicago, I used to go to Puerto Rico every year, all the time. You know, it felt like home to me. This is where I work, and home was Puerto Rico. But now I'm in a situation that I feel homeless because my mother is not there anymore. My sister, the one that passed away, was the one taking care of my mother. And we had to take her, she's now living in Florida with my other sister. And I feel I don't have my family there, you know? I don't have my mother, I don't have my sister, and I don't know if I can take it. So this is a really hard question that you're asking me. I want to say that home is where my husband and my son and my grandson are. And Puerto Rico it's like a love, my big love that just broke my heart.
I'm sorry I asked that and put you through that, but I think it's one of those things that when we're talking about writing and we're talking about, you know, especially folks who've made a journey, that, you know, it is one of those questions of how does that affect you? And you know, for people like me, you know, I'm someone who grew up here and has lived here his whole life. So I really never fully understand, except through reading, that notion of journey, of, you know, going somewhere else. So I think it's amazing to think about that and how it impacts you as a writer, and how that may come through. But I thought maybe if each of you would be interested again in maybe reading one more piece for us, and let the audience hear that.
There you go. So you start?
Usher, I'm ready. Okay, so this is a piece in the new collection, and it's a piece that I wish I had read when I was young. It's called "To the Small Boy Who Was Night." I too used to place a veil over my head. I was either a widow or a bride, because they both left something behind at church, like I had on the day of my first communion. How I envied the girls in their white gowns, the lace of baby cribs that kept out the flies made me feel so otherworldly, angel-like. But I was taken to the altar unadorned and stripped of my crown. Standing next to a girl in silk gloves, her Cinderella slippers poking out like doves beneath her dress, I felt absent, removed from my true self. When the priest placed the Eucharist in my mouth, he stored a piece of bread on an empty shelf. It remains there, unclaimed and forgotten, like that child at the altar whose heavenly light never reached the spot where he stood. I want to tell you, dear one, that light doesn't only come from above. It also comes from within. I have felt its heat many times. The first, when I walked into a field of sunflowers and recognized the beauty of my kin, and when I borrowed mommy's lipstick to plant the ruby kiss on my reflection, and when I draped abuela's white rebozo around my shoulders, how I shuddered, shaking off the cold gaze of ridicule from school. I learned to be as confident as a butterfly, as elegant as a moth, dodging shame by coming out of hiding every day and then each night.
Okay. So let me do this. This one is called Herencias, Inheritance. Should I read it in Spanish or English?
I think read it in both.
Okay. Vamos a ver. And again, it's about this, the fact that I grew up in a, not only my house, but my family was mostly women, you know, on my mother's side. You know, I hardly have any male cousins, you know, and we were four sisters, my mother, my grandmother, so it's all women. So, herencias. No sé en qué momento mis hermanas me habitaron, cuando saquearon mi cuarto para mudar sus pertenencias y amueblarme de sus sueños. No comprendo cómo la abuela se vistió en mis labios, balbuceó opiniones y decidió mi futuro. Y mi madre dibujó en mi rostro esta máscara gemela suya, con todas sus preocupaciones maquilladas en el perfil. No recuerdo cuando mis primas me calzaron sus convicciones para marchar juntas con carteles de protesta. Y en qué día mis tías llegaron de visita y se apoderaron de todos los rincones solitarios de mi hogar. He empacado miles de maletas, llenado sus barrigas de sueños truncados. Desempaco y me pruebo las ropas legadas. Algunas son anchas, infinitas como el mar, permiten nadar sin restricciones. Otras son estrechas y anticuadas, cortan la respiración, confinan las pasiones. No sé por qué mi sangre pesa como un tanque lleno de sobrevivientes de otras guerras. Y cuando caigo, un batallón de almas me recoge para sanarme las heridas con su botica de remedios. ¿Por qué será que soy 100 mujeres en una, híbrido de posibilidades vírgenes? y siento en mi piel el dolor y la risa de todas las guerreras que heredé. Inheritance. I don't know at what moment my sister inhabited me, when they looted my room to install their own belongings and furnish me with their dreams. I don't understand how La Abuela got dressed in my lips, blabbered opinions, and decided my future. And my mother drew on my face this max, the twin of her own, with all her worries painted on my own profile. I don't remember when my cousins shot me with their convictions to set off together with protest banners, nor what day my aunts came to visit and took over all the empty corners of my home. I packed thousands of suitcases, filled their bellies with truncated dreams. I unpack and try on the clothes I inherited. Some are wide and infinite as the sea. They allow for swimming without restraints. Others are narrow and antiquated, cutting off breath, confining passions. And don't know why my blood is as heavy as a tank, full of survivors of other wars. And when I fall, a battalion of souls pick me up to heal my wounds with their kit of remedies. Why am 100 women in one, hybrid of virgin possibilities, and I feel on my skin the pain and the laughter of all the warrior women I inherited.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you both for those. As a final question, I would like to know from both of you, since you're both also teachers in different areas, but you know, when somebody asks you about, you know, becoming a writer as a passion that they think they want to pursue, you know, what do you like to tell them?
I tell them first and foremost, they need to be good readers. As I mentioned earlier, the reader to writer is a small step. And as long as you are still dazzled by reading a book, reading a poem, a story, that energy, that wonder is going to sustain you, even in moments of doubt. The second thing I tell them is not to believe in this thing called writer's block, that there are ways to find your way through it. Because if you define what's happening to you as writer's block, then you can also surrender to the inability to continue. But I said, and also don't define writing as actual writing only. Writing is also reading. Writing is also looking around you, going into a museum. All that is part of the writing process. So if you're not physically typing or doing something on pencil on page, then you're moving through your environment.
Giovanni?
Well, definitely. Reading a lot, and some things that I encounter with some students, you know, they show me a poem or something like that. I don't teach creative writing. So in my case, it's not like Rigoberto. But sometimes they don't want to edit it. Or they want it, that's how it came out. That's how you know, I want to leave it like that. And I'm like, no, you know. I always tell people, you know, I'm more than writing, I spend a lot of time reading and thinking, you know, and then editing, you know, and whatever. But you have to learn through that. I mean, I don't think, like, for example, anyone say, oh, I'm going to be a poet to be rich. You know, you kind of know if you're a poet, you're going to be poor. It's just like that. You know, maybe if you write a novel and Oprah picks it, but it's just like that. So it's not like I have a few different guys. I was a social worker once in Chicago. Because my undergraduate is that. When the student tell me I want to be a social worker, I don't say no. I don't say no, but I'm like, oh, you know, it was very depressing and you want to save the world. And sorry, social workers cannot save hardly anyone. But yeah, you know, encourage them. You know, I was once in this workshop that they had here in Chicago. And I didn't like that sometimes new people will come and they really criticize them. This is horrible. This is whatever. Like, no, you always, because your first poems were bad too, you know, so you have to tell them, you know, keep writing, keep, and read a lot, because only by reading a lot, you learn to know when what you write is good. Because you have to be your own critic, and not everything I write is good. You know what I mean? And a poet from Puerto Rico, actually, Nayris Rivera, she told me a long time ago, don't be dying to publish everything you write. You know, you need to know when some poems that you write are maybe just personal, which ones are good and which ones belong in a book. Not everything you write is to be in a book.
I think that's a really good point, to just try and write and then think about the other stuff later. You know, think about being published. Think about, you know, reading it out loud after you've thought about, is it good? But definitely write. Just write and write and read, as you both said, I think is so important for people to grasp. And I do think it's funny, as you mentioned, those who want to take it from when it first came out and not think about editing, and without recognizing that editing is always part of the process. So I think, you know, I want to thank you both for doing this with us. The hour has gone by very quickly. You're both wonderful, and the works that you read tonight are beautiful. And I want to thank you both for being with us and helping us celebrate Poetry Month in April. So thank you, Joanny. Thank you, Rigoberto.
Thank you, Rigoberto. Te quiero mucho.
También.
Mi padrino.
To our audience. Thanks, everybody, for being
Bye-bye,
here.
Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next week to hear from acclaimed writer R.O. Kwan. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.